everybody. Welcome to the 86th episode of the Manor Podcast. I'm your co-host, Roger Bodie, joined as always with my best friend and other co-host, Michael Hamilton. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Always remember, mind your manners. Thanks for watching, everybody.
You playing some Balatro, however you say that over there.
What, huh?
We got a podcast to do. I know it's we're approaching the Pro Tour and it's kind of I did not close my door. I got a Misty.
Yeah, you go tend to Misty. We did the podcast recording.
Okay. You play Balatro.
I got a good run going on. I got the black deck and it's really hard to get a good starting run with the black deck. But I got six good jokers in my opener, so I got some good stuff going on here.
Wait, six good jokers? I thought you could only have five jokers.
Yeah, but with the black deck, you get to go up to six jokers, but you get one less hand play per round. So that's why it's really hard to get going at the start, because all your opening rounds are really hard. But then once you get your six joker, the run really starts cooking. So
yeah, you also get less interest, right? Or not interest, less money for having less hands.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I got some jokers that give me more money, and then some jokers that give me more malts, and then, you know.
Okay, so are we still doing a podcast?
Do I have to?
I mean, technically no.
Technically no. Okay, fine. I'll play more Balatro later. Unlucky. Okay, so it's also nice that we're talking about a nice and uncontroversial topic this episode that nobody will disagree with and nobody would ever get flamed on Twitter for.
The Wolfpack?
Yeah, being the best team in Flesh and Blood.
That's not what you told me this episode was about. Thought we were just talking about the Wolfpack.
And why it's the best team in Flesh and Blood. Do we need to restart the whole episode now?
No.
Is this not what we're talking about?
No, we're talking. Let's go. Run it down. So, I know you've been involved in some Twitter drama about this.
Yeah, and you know what? Phrasing aside, sure, I could have phrased it more gently, but you know what? At the end of the day, you got to have a chip on your shoulder about some things, and we're competing, and that's what we're doing ultimately. So I think it's a weird day and age where good players are just expected to be humble at all times. And I feel like any sign of showing any amount of ego is really frowned upon at all times. Like, you're never allowed to be super proud of your accomplishments. And you know, you and Brody Spurlock and Michael Fung and anybody else on the team that's had a lot of really good accomplishments, been very humble and gracious in victory. But you guys can be gracious, but I want to hype you up. That's kind of like what I like to do. I like being your ego for, you should be proud of these accomplishments, and it means something to be really good and accomplished in something. So if you guys can't do it personally, I want to be there to be kind of the hype person and ego behind the humbleness that is the rest of the wolf pack.
Makes sense. That's sweet. So this all started when LSS released their like roundtable discussion about what to look out for at the Pro Tour, what's going on, right? And they talked about teams to keep an eye on, and they talked about Blue Pitch, and Blue Pitch is really good. They kind of crush us at Worlds.
That's not what they said. If that's what they said, none of this would ever be happening, because that's fine. You can show a spotlight on a different team. I'm all for that. I'm not saying that the discourse should only be about the Wolfpack all the time, and that if somebody doesn't talk about the Wolfpack, somebody should talk about the Wolfpack. That's not the argument. That's a silly argument to make. I would never make that argument. The argument I'm making is, if you are asking the pointed question of who is the best team in Flesh and Blood, that's a very specific question that has a very specific answer of the Wolfpack. It's like I said in my follow-up tweet below that in 1996, looking at Michael Jordan and the Bulls in their championship run and being like, oh, you know, they're a good team and they had some good results, but not everybody on the Bulls is Michael Jordan. And I think the Orlando Magic is probably the best team in the NBA right now. And it's like, what are you talking about? No, it's clear. It's clear. Like, it's just like there's dominant, amazing people on this team that are just exceptionally talented. Not everybody on the team has to be exceptionally talented 100% of the time for it to be the best at something. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fair. I think one tweet that kind of stuck out with me and like kind of not in the best taste was Brian Gottlieb tweeted about he basically said two of the best five players in the world are on the Wolfpack and the rest of the team hasn't done anything or something. Essentially, yeah,
when
that vibe,
when the other 74 of us,
yeah,
yeah,
which I kind of wanted to address that one specifically because I went through the Discord. I'm like, how many members do we have? Our Discord, it says it has 26 users, two of them are bots, one of them is a member's kid, and one of them I don't think has played Flesh and Blood in quite a while.
Steven from Team Covenant,
so we have 22 real member, I don't want to say real members, that's not the right vibe, but 22 people that are playing Flesh and Blood and are I don't know, Donovan went to Harvard,
even somewhat, yeah,
but I don't think he's ever posted a message in the Discord. He's mostly in so that he can do an online draft with us. And I guess our team also has a lot of accomplishments outside of, I don't even know who the two of the five is it me and Michael, is it Michael and Brody?
Yeah,
is it me and Brody? I don't know what that's. I also think Mara and Andrew both have pretty strong claims as well. They both crush PT3 and have a lot of other good results. So,
yeah, I took less umbrage with this post as a result or directly because I just think this one was mostly a meme. But I do hate the overall discourse that kind of formed around this where, well, you know, there's really only Michael Hamilton, Michael Fung, and Brody Spurlock, and everybody else on the Wolfpack doesn't matter. And you can't attribute those three players' results to the rest of the team because the rest of the team sucks. And, you know, when the rest of the, when everybody on the team starts crushing the tournament, like every tournament all the time, then we could talk about you guys being the best team in Flesh and Blood. And that's really arbitrary and weird. And at the end of the day, where there's been, what, three total Pro Tours in the world so far and two world championships. So that's really only five world grandstanding total champions that you could have for each one of these individual tournaments cumulative. That's it. Like you can't have everybody on the team having won or, you know, top eighted a Pro Tour or Worlds at this point because it's just not, there haven't been enough tournaments. And basically, what I consider the Wolfpack to be is the equivalent to there was a pro testing team at Magic the Gathering called the Pantheon. And the Pantheon, let's just read off the names of the Pantheon. It started as Sam Black, Kai Boud, Andrew Cuneo, Reed Duke, John Finkel, Tom Martell, Gabriel Nassif, Paul Rietzel, and Guadernus Vudagiris, I believe, Alexander West, Yelger Wiegersma, and then later on became added to Reed Duke, Owen Turtenwald, William Jensen, Shahar Shenhar, Matt Costa, Antonio De Rosa, Zvi Mashowitz, Jacob Wilson, and Brad Nelson. So that's 20 players. And would anybody ever say like, well, because all these 20 players didn't always do amazing at every single Pro Tour, then, you know, those guys suck. They're never the best team in Magic the Gathering tournament testing or of that era. And it's like, no, of course not. Each one of these people had their own breakout tournaments and were amazingly skilled and talented players in their own right. But there was never a tournament where all 20 of these players were all 20 slots of the top eight or top 20 of a tournament result. That's just a ridiculous expectation.
Yeah, that is. I agree. That is kind of a ridiculous expectation. I also think like the I don't know. I think like trying to say someone is the best team, there's like a lot of different metrics you can look at. But, and like, if you're trying to like weigh it down based on team size, like if you have more members, then you have to have better results to be the best team, which is like somewhat reasonable. But I don't know, if a team, let's say a hypothetical world where a team had 100 players in it, but they won every major ever, is that not the best team?
Probably. So, there's an argument for it.
Yeah, there's arguments against the team, I guess.
Yeah, and there's something else aside from this. Like, I'm pointing to kind of just the fact, like, my initial post was just the fact that, you know, you won the first world championship. Michael Fung won a U.S. Nationals and a Pro Tour now. And Brody Spurlock. Michael Fung got second at the first U.S. Nationals. Yeah. He didn't win. So we don't actually even have a U.S. Nationals winner on the team. So I'm just wrong about that.
Hey, I won U.S. Nationals.
Oh, yeah, you did.
What did That's I right. Here?
You just win so many things, it's hard to keep track of sometimes, Michael. It's just hard to remember every single one of your accomplishments. But anyways, long story short, that's a crazy, crazy thing for any one team to have like on their roster, even if it's concentrated among a handful of players. And, you know, would you not attribute testing with the Wolfpack and our processes and just the overall just team dynamics to some amount of your success?
I attribute a lot of it to the Wolfpack. I know I had some success before joining the Wolfpack, but I feel like just having access to so many good players to bounce ideas off of and talk through and play test different matchups, like that's a lot of my success. And it's also just like you're consistently able to play a game against someone who's very good at Flesh and Blood, because trying to play into random people on Talishar is both much less enjoyable in my experience and much less useful than playing against players that are just very good at the game.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that process clearly is working. And even if we're helping you or whoever wins a tournament or does well in a tournament as a whole, even 1% better, like that's a worthwhile endeavor for the team. Because while it's nice if certain individuals, you know, have these really breakout or dominant performances, and we would love for everybody on the team to be, you know, the top 20 of a specific tournament, it's just not a really reasonable expectation. And I think at the end of the day, what the other backup argument that I can make for the Wolfpack being the best team is just the vibe. Like, I can't speak to other team dynamics, but I just know that there's we were on several testing teams before the Wolfpack, and there were people on it that kind of had specific mindsets, people who are like meta slaves, sometimes they'll say, or people who are just really focused on specific, very granular processes and just kind of turn it into kind of more of a job or a very specific process. But that's never what it's been like or what it will ever be on the Wolfpack. It's really more of just a group of people that like to hang out and play Flesh and Blood because we all like and are passionate about the game. And, you know, we've done a lot of testing this past week. How many matches have you put on the team testing form?
Oh, no, don't ask me that. I'm getting called out. I don't think I reported a game.
Yeah, me neither, dude. And you know what? That's fine. I don't think most people are very particular about the team testing form. We just kind of usually post in a whatever channel, like, hey, I went 2-1 into Michael today. I had this note about the matchup. And if you're interested, we could talk more about it. And sometimes people are interested, and sometimes you're on Bolton and you just are talking into the void and nobody cares. But you know what? That's fine, because people should just do whatever they're interested and engaged with. They don't necessarily all have to be locked into whatever we think is like the specific team deck or whatever.
Yeah. I think the best part about like the talking into the void thing is a lot of the time, like I'll be like, okay, I want to work on this hero. And I'll go back and just like read through the last few months of like messages in that channel. And I'll be like, okay, I get it. I learned a lot of things. And that's just like a really useful resource that we're kind of like building up even when we're just talking into the void.
Yeah, absolutely. Like there have been times where I wanted to play like I guess I was getting into specifics, but I probably shouldn't do that because the Pro Tour is coming up and I don't want to talk about decks I've cycled through on the Pro Tour that weren't Bolton for a while. But I've had very similar experiences and have definitely learned a lot through those types of conversations as well. And if one day somebody on the team, aside from me, wants to learn how to play Raiden Bolton, there are lots of shouts into the void from me there.
One last comment on the best team discussion. We since we kind of just jumped into that. Alex from the Fabled Academy actually did an interview with me and Brody about what it means to be the best team, what we think is the best team, and a lot of questions like that. And I just wanted to shout out that video because I think it's like a pretty good discussion on at least my opinion on it. How I think, like, I personally think the Wolfpack is the best team for me, at least the team that I would want to be on the most. And that's basically what I said in the video. Like, you can have whatever dynamics and criteria for rating the best team, but I love all the guys on the Wolfpack, everyone on the Wolfpack, not all guys, everyone on the Wolfpack. And it just feels like a big family almost. And I think that's like part of the vibe. It's like very, and I say family in a good way, not like fighting on the holidays kind of thing. That's never been my family experience, I guess, but.
That was my family experience, but, you know, not my current family experience or the Wolfpack family experience. So, you know, life gets better. But yeah, I think there's been a handful of drama at over the 2 years we've been on the team now for this point, year and a half, 2 years. It's been a long time. And I think I was usually at the center of it because I'm just usually a pretty hyperbolic person sometimes. I don't know if anybody's ever noticed this, but I can definitely rub people the wrong way, especially when you're first getting to know me or my dynamics can be challenging. But, you know, I try to learn from that. And since then, we have not had any drama that I can think of recently.
Yeah, I don't think there's been any drama. There has been some disagreements, but they've been like peacefully resolved. Everyone just like kind of shares their opinion. But I don't think we've had drama since.
Long time.
I'm saying since. Sometime. And it might have been 2022 the last time I remember drama in the team.
Yeah.
I don't remember any drama from last year.
Yeah, me neither.
So.
Yeah. So the vibe of the team is definitely really good. And I guess to then address some other things that I think also get levied around on internet discourse lately, which is, well, this is a very US-centric thing. And, you know, it's very wrong to attack, I think, Team Blue Pitch, and not attack, but to downplay other teams that aren't in the United States, because only you can't just consider only US results in these criteria. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. And I don't think that I think it's true that other teams from around the world definitely have issues with visibility because they just don't have the same opportunities for coverage or the same amount of tournaments that are operating in the United States that we are obviously very lucky and fortunate to have. But at the end of the day, if there were a team that had as many consistent champions or a Michael Hamilton-esque type player that just shows up and usually crushes everything, or people who are just putting up consistent results in Callings, Battle Hardens, Road to Nationals, every single level of tournament you can think of, I could see be more sympathetic to that argument. It was kind of like when Pablo Pintor was kind of in the argument for best player in the world for a while instead of you, Michael. And people were saying, well, he has the like Pro Tour top 8 and Michael has this and that. And I was like, okay, I can see that argument. And I was open to having it, and I wasn't like upset being like, no, it has to be Michael. He's an American. But, you know, since then you've won a US Nationals and a world championship since then. And that's not to say Pablo isn't a phenomenal player. I like Pablo a lot. He's a really nice guy. I enjoy hanging out with him. I think he's amazing at Flesh and Blood. But at the end of the day, when you're talking about the best at something, like the actual pinnacle, very tippy top of the mountain, there can only be that the one. Like, you can't be like, oh, okay, cool. Like, we're both the best, you know, you're both my best friend. You're both the best player in the world. Everybody's the best team in the world. It's like, it doesn't, like, we're competing. Like, this is a competitive nature endeavor that we're going on. And that's just going to create these different measures of success, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. And what you said about the US tournaments too, I do feel for that a lot. Like, I look at the tournaments I've done well at. Basically none of them have been tournaments that I've had to travel overseas. Like, talk about tournament availability. Also, it's like extra difficult to play well when you're dealing with jet lag, when your travel plans are 10 hours on a flight, maybe 1 or 2 days before the tournament. It's just really hard to play your best in those situations. A lot of stuff goes into the mental game of just like being in really good shape mentally when you're playing card games. And like, you look at the majors we've won, both Worlds and the Pro Tour that Michael won, we're both in the US, so we didn't have that traveling kind of disadvantage, I would say. And then like, you look at the tournaments that we haven't done so well, you look at Lille, you look at the Barcelona World Championship. Those tournaments are the tournaments that have been our kind of rough tournaments. So,
but even in Lille, didn't we have three people bubble top eight?
Yes. Well, no, two bubbled. I don't think Andrew was ever alive for top eight.
And didn't you win that Battle Harden the next day?
Well, I got an extra day of sleep. And I got lucky. But I was wide open in the top eight draft. I wheeled Red Mounting Anger. That you can only credit, like, sometimes things just go your way. You're trying to force Icelander, but everyone else is trying to force Icelander, and they're like, no, you are not Icelander. And I'm like, okay, I will take the wheeled Red Mounting Anger. You got me.
Yeah. So just saying, you won the Battle Harden in a little. So it's not like we can't ever do anything in overseas tournaments. We still got some games sometimes. And LA is a 3-hour time difference. So like, that's almost like, so somewhat jet lag, right? You know?
Yeah, though I am going to Texas on Wednesday, so I'll have a week to get used to that 2-hour difference, then I'll only have one more hour to go to LA.
Yeah.
Right? Texas is Mountain Time, not Central.
Mm-hmm.
Or is Texas Central?
I don't know.
I think it's Mountain Time.
And anyway, I think it depends. Texas is a huge, huge state. I think they're like three different time zones depending on where you're at.
There's no way it's three, but it might be two.
You could have said four, and I'd be like, oh, okay. Would have drawn the line at five. I don't think there's five, but, you know, it's a huge state. There's like, you'll see some maps, and it's like, I think like half of Europe can fit inside of Texas. It's just like, you can put like from like Portugal to like Germany inside of Texas or something like that. It's stupid big.
I'm suspicious of this. I would believe Alaska, but Texas, I don't know.
Alaska, but like Alaska's like,
you can fit like 2.5 Texases in Alaska, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, Alaska's just a weird state, dude. It's just like so much territory and so little there. But you know, with global warming, it's probably a sweet place to move. You just get like tropical sunshine all the time soon. Maybe we should look into moving to Texas or Alaska.
Alaska,
yeah.
But not Texas. Not Texas. Texas is not the place to move.
Texas is,
it's hot.
Yeah, we'll put that aside. But you know what? If you live in Texas, I hope you're happy. It's not like Indiana's much better. It's not like we're living in the lap of luxury here.
So I did want to talk about some of the, like, what the Wolfpack is like, what it's like being on the team, some of the advantages to being on it. You want to transition into that?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Okay, so I think I guess how it works is what I wrote in our show notes. I would say like we kind of have just 20 or so people that are messaging on the forums, that the forums, the Discord. It's not forums, it's the Discord. And there's a channel for each hero. And after, whenever you play games or whenever you have thoughts, you post those thoughts in the channel. People engage with you, talk about it. Sometimes if you're talking about Raiden Bolton, no one responds because nobody's working on Raiden Bolton. And I'm like, Roger, cut this bad popper, play this other card instead. You're going to lose to Dromai anyway. And that's about it for the channels. We also try to keep our current deck list that we're working on pinned. So if someone's like, hey, I want to try out this hero, then you can play with someone's updated deck list and learn from it. And also, it's easier to give feedback on a deck when you know what the exact 80 is. So,
yeah, absolutely.
That's basically it. We have, for a while, we were doing like regular meetings every Friday. But as the team got larger and larger, those meetings kind of got less efficient. It's a lot harder to have a good meeting with 20 people in it because there's just too many voices. I don't know if we ever had 20 people in a voice call, but like we had like 18 or something at one point.
Yeah, it was definitely some big people. I think we were hitting the... No, it's like 100 people that can fit inside of a Discord call before you have to like upgrade, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not that big yet.
Yeah, I think it was 25 and then they upped the count once COVID hit and more people were using Discord for bigger things online.
Yeah, makes sense. So to talk about that a little bit, though, and kind of delve back into like there's no team deck or whatever, where on the Wolfpack, like Mara is completely free to be like the Dromai specialist and work on Dromai as much as she wants. And like I'm free to be the Bolton degen and just work on Bolton as much as I want. And everybody just kind of picks a deck that they're going to make sure that they have fun on. And that's why, you know, despite being the Lexi being the best deck, not everybody on the Wolfpack was always on Lexi. Like Michael Fung took Oldham to PT Baltimore, and we were all reasonably convinced. And I think he was even just on Fresh and Buds talking about like he was really apprehensive about Oldham, and he thought he had a horrible Lexi matchup, and that he was expecting to lose in top eight to Lexi's because, you know, Lexi was just the best deck in that tournament. And he just kind of got a little lucky where Mara got Brody in top four, and then he got good matchups into Dromai the rest of the way. So like that just happens sometimes, but it's not like we were all really focusing and hammering in on Lexi at that time where we just expected everybody on the team to play that deck.
I'm realizing his top eight was Azalea, Dromai, right? Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Just how he drew it up.
Yeah, no Lexis.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, we really did think Lexi was the best deck by a reasonable amount for that tournament. But even still, a lot of us were working on other things. I know John Magnuson had his Anathos Oldheim deck that I was almost on for the Pro Tour.
I played, yeah.
And then I like 4 days before, I'm like, I can't be Lexi with this deck. I'm switching. And then I just scrambled to learn Lexi. And I made some pretty big mistakes from pivoting to Lexi so late. I remember there was one turn I tried to block around something. I've tried to play around a Pummel by blocking with my New Horizon. And I would respond to the Pummel by loading my Arsenal. But then the New Horizon would trigger and kill my Arsenal. And I blocked with it. I do the thing. I load that bow. I put my card in my Arsenal. And I pick up my New Horizon and put it in the graveyard. And then I look at my New Horizon. And I look at the card I just put in my Arsenal. And I pick up the card in my Arsenal and put it in my graveyard too. I'm like, oops.
At least you didn't discard the Pummel trigger, you know? You got one over on your opponent.
Yeah, I think I would have just had one more card if I let the Pummel trigger resolve and just discarded that, because I would have had the resource card and the arrow. Mm-hmm. So I would have just lost one of them. But, you know, what can you do? What
can you do? Oh. So, yeah, I that's always been a really rewarding process to the team. And I think the other thing that I think maybe we could have been concerned about, or other teams worry about or something like that, is that like their secret tech leaking, or like their specific builds of a deck like leaking out, or they have some hidden broken team secrets and things like that. And I don't think, even when you were on Wounded Bull Icelander, I don't think any of us knew like, oh man, this deck's broken. Like we have to keep this deck a secret. It was just like, oh, we found this cool new thing. I guess you get to go win a free nationals because you found a broken deck. But it was never like, don't tell anyone about this. This is a team secret. We broke the format. Please. We have to make sure we're a unified team secret keeping entity. And even in that U.S. Nationals tournament, were you the only person on the team to play Bolander in the actual like Nationals itself tournament?
You played Bolander, right?
I think I played not Bolander, and then I scrubbed the calling, and then I scrubbed Nationals, and then I was like, okay, Michael went undefeated, I'll play Bolander. And then I played like a hedged version of Bolander and made top eight of that calling. So it's just like, you know.
I think Tim was also on Bolander. I don't know if he played Nationals or he just played the calling. I don't remember.
I remember he had a pretty good run, though.
I remember him in the calling. He was doing really well.
Yeah. So, but that's just something we just don't worry about on the team necessarily. And I think that just really speaks to just kind of like the vibe overall where like, I can't imagine anybody on the team like leaking secrets or something like that if we did have them, but it's just not really what we're focused on, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's actually pretty challenging with making content sometimes too, is like there's things that I want to talk about, but I'm like, it's not really mine to talk about. I can't really, like, a lot of other people's work has gone into it too, and that's like, that makes it pretty challenging, I guess.
But yeah, but to that end though, as long as like you're not being super public about it, like nobody cares if you test outside the team at the same time. Like, as long as you're being open about it and you're not like hiding it or like sharing team information with people that the information that's not yours with somebody else outside the team, then in that regard. But like, I've been working with Ellie Bird and even Tarek a little bit upon like Raiden, Bolton and stuff like that. And I've just been like, hey, I had these games with Tarek the other day and they went like this. And I put that into the void of the Bolton channel, and I'm like, hey, you know, Ellie told me about this idea, I really like this idea, I think I'm gonna use this in my deck, and put that into the Bolton void. But like, anybody is free to kind of like go and, you know, test and make sure that they're getting the help that they want or the support that they want. You're not locked into like, these are the only 20 people you're allowed to play with leading up to events or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's really good too. I think for PT2 especially, that came up for me where I was working on the Oldheim deck. I was messaging people, like the Oldheim deck that we ended up playing it, and that I ended up playing on PT2. I was messaging Ben, who's now a member of the Wolfpack, but was not at the time, and getting a lot of input from him, and also talking to John and the Wolfpack about it. And I remember one thing that always stood out to me as really funny was like, Ben and someone on the Wolfpack both messaged me, what about Yellow Earthlore Surge? Like within like an hour of each other. And I was like, oh my God, this is genius.
But honestly, that kind of just talks about like why the Wolfpack is the way it is, right? Because it's just like, since we're not locked in and you were messaging Ben and working with Ben a lot, then it's just like after that tournament, you were like, hey, why don't we just add Ben to this channel? And like, oh, okay, cool. Now Ben's in the Wolfpack server and he's a member of the Wolfpack and cool. And like, that's kind of how a lot of the team kind of grew organically, because like you would just be working with somebody outside the Wolfpack, and then like after the tournament or even like 2 weeks before the tournament, I think we added Merrick and Mara like right before Worlds this past year. And yeah, it just works.
Yeah, I know Travis, who's also our editor. Thank you, Travis, and a member of the team. When I was working on Wounded Bull Icelander too, like everyone on the team was supportive. They're like, yeah, this seems cool. But like, it was kind of, it felt like it was like, nobody was actively like doing, like putting the work in to figure out what cards should be included and stuff. There was like some suggestions like, hey, what about this? Hey, what about this? But nobody was like, here's my version of Wounded Bull Icelander. So it was like, kind of felt like it was on me to figure it out basically. And I ended up asking Travis for some games because Travis, I knew, was playing a lot of Dromai at the time. And I'm like, no one on the team was a Dromai specialist. None of us believed in Dromai that much. And I'm like, I need some Wounded Bull Icelander to Dromai games. And I messaged Travis outside of the team. I'm like, hey, I'm playing this weird Icelander deck. Can you keep it secret? I need some Dromai reps. And he's like, yeah. And then I played some games into him. And he was like, okay, I want to play Wounded Bull Icelander at Nats. And I'm like, I wasn't sure if that was okay.
It was your deck. It's your
yeah problem. But I think knowing what I know now about the team and people would have been pretty cool with that, I think. But I at the time I was like really worried about it. I'm like, you can play it in the calling but maybe not Nationals. But I kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, and I guess overall thinking back to drama, I guess like I do remember the one piece of drama from last year, and it was about Winter's Bite, where we put blue Winter's Bite in our Icelander decks, and then
Was last year.
Yeah, and then people who are working on Lexi were like, "Oh, Winter's Bite's cracked in Lexi," and so
we put red Winter's Bite in our Icelander deck.
Yeah, and that was kind of like a conflict we had to work out, because we were talking about how good Winter's Bite was, and they wanted to keep Winter's Bite technology down low for the PT. And I remember just being like, if I can't just talk about a card in general, then like, I think that's probably too far, but it was something that we had to discuss, and I was still sympathetic to their arguments. And yeah, it's just like one of those things where whenever you have that many people on a team, those kinds of things are just going to pop up. But I've definitely learned a lot in terms of toning down my hyperbole to work out actual disagreements when they arise like that.
That makes sense.
And honestly, there are people on the team that still are super hyperbolic, like myself sometimes, and then like, ooh, that hyperbole is rubbing me a little the wrong way. Maybe I should tone down my hyperbole so I don't rub other people the wrong way. And it's just like, I've learned so much. I've grown so much as just a person being on the team, Michael.
That's great.
I know. Best team in the world.
Growing as a person.
We kind of talked a lot about it already in parts, but I guess I would push back on the organized part of organized testing team. I guess
that's
we're definitely a testing team, but as we kind of talked about earlier with not updating the form as well as we should have and reporting our matches as well as we should, and just kind of like, there's no like, okay, practice is at 8 a.m. every day, be there. It's just not really that kind of organization. It's more like, hey, if you have some free time, let's like post that you're interested in getting some games, and then if somebody else has some free time, they'll hang out and get some games with you. Or if you just want to hang out in the channel and watch some games while you're working on your stupid spreadsheet for your job, cool, do that. And if you are busy and you have some life events coming up, then you need to take some time away, cool, we'll be here when you get back. And that's really more than what, like, it's more of the team than it is the organized testing, I guess.
Yeah, that's fair. There is like schedule, like people schedule things, but it's more like, hey, do you want to do this thing tomorrow? Do you want to do this thing Wednesday? Whatever.
Yeah. And,
I think that's one thing that helped me a lot for the third pro tour when I was pivoting to Lexi, was there was like, hey, we're going to have a Lexi discussion at this time. And then there were like seven of us there. And I just, since I was just picking up Lexi, I'd been playing all time the last 2 weeks or something, I was like, I will take all the notes, just come to this meeting and pick up so many things. And we do that both for specific heroes and constructed. Also, we've done that for limited meetings where we'll meet up and talk about, we'll have a scheduled thing to meet up and talk about like how to draft X hero or pick orders for X hero.
Yeah.
And kind of go through that.
And I guess touching on limited, that would be one of the things you would think like we do really well, right? It's limited prep. We have so many people. We could fill two whole draft pods by ourselves with team members. And it's like, I think maybe I've done one 8-person team Wolfpack draft, maybe two, since Heavy Hitters came out. And I don't think too many have happened as a whole, just because it's hard, even with 20 people, people's schedules don't often line up exactly the same way on for 4 hours or whatever you need to do a draft at any particular time very often.
Yeah, that's true. That's probably one of the biggest disadvantages to our like flexible schedule, is when the schedule is so flexible and we're not like making sure people's schedules line up when they're joining the team. It's just like more free than for draft. It's just going to be very hard to get 8 people together to draft at a specific time. But we've had a lot of situations where we'll have like 3 to 5 people or 3 to 6 people that want to draft, and they all go hop in the same Runaways queue and we just draft with a few other people.
Thanks, Runaways.
Thanks. We appreciate you guys. It's a great server.
Oh, boy. That being said, like, and like, we're friends with a lot of the members of the Runaways. Like, I like and respect a lot of the people on that team. Like, I don't think, like, I think the connotation that can come off a lot too, if like you say you're the best at something, which I guess is tautologically true, is like you're saying like, well, you're better than them, and like you think that you're in a position of superiority because of that, and like that's not really what I think of, or that's not the perspective that I have in mind when I say that we're the best team in Flesh and Blood. I don't think that we're necessarily then better, or that like people are like beneath us, and that everybody should look up at the Wolfpack and be like, Like, I just think that our talent and skills are just usually a cut above what other people are doing. But that's a very thin margin at this point in time. Like I said, there's only been 5 major world tournaments at this point in time, and that can change. You know, another team could start popping off and showing us what's up. And if that happens, then cool. They're the best team in the world, and I'm fine with that. But they also shouldn't then have the perspective that like they're then better. It's kind of like the same thing. Like, I had to go through this a lot growing up with just kind of being naturally like intelligent, or just being able to like coast on like my abilities without having to like really study hard or apply myself in school. And for a lot of the time, that did manifest in a non-zero amount of arrogance, where it's just like, what do you mean you have to like study and do all this stuff? Like, can't you just like stay up till midnight playing video games and cruise into the test playing and just on like 2 hours of sleep and get a B? Like, come on. Like, I can do that. I'm so cool. And I just don't have that same attitude anymore. And I think, and one of my big things as a father is basically, how do you encourage somebody to have that chip on their shoulder to be like, yeah, I'm cool. I have something to prove. I want to compete. I want to be the best at something, without then having that superiority complex that like there's just such a fine line to walk between like cockiness and swagger, I guess. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
And it's something that I've always struggled with, and probably I don't want to say always will, but yeah, it's just hard.
Yeah. You see my approach is just stay away from all of it. I'm just like, I'm just going to show up and play some cards. I'm a casual Flesh and Blood player now, you see. Just here to have fun.
Yeah, that's fair. And that is definitely a way you can live your life and handle things. But I guess, like, let's get into this then. Like, what drives you to compete then? Like, why even show up to the tournaments and try to win? Is it just the money, or is it just like you just, like, what about the process do you actually like then?
So ever since I found out about tournaments for large amounts of money, I was very interested in just like winning money, supporting my life by playing games, basically. And the first game I played was Smash Bros, and there's not a lot of money in Smash Bros compared to card games, first off. And also, like, losing in games where it's like reaction based, it didn't feel like as clear the path to improving, and dropping combos was also like kind of frustrating. But like moving to card games, every time I lose in a card game, I'm like, either my deck was bad, or I made mistakes, or I got unlucky. But getting unlucky is going to happen. And I think like the amount of variance that is in card games is generally, especially Flesh and Blood, is less than people make it out to be. And I think that's actually true for Magic too. Even like Magic is reasonably higher variance than Flesh and Blood. At least it was in the days that I played Magic. I don't know what Magic looks like now. Like, if all the one drops are like, you answer this or you die, then I mean, it's going to be higher variance. But I think Magic was lower variance than people made it out to be, especially with best 2 out of 3. And then I think like if you are the best or even very good at something, then you can make a comfortable living by doing that thing. And that's always been what's kind of driven me. And then I also just really enjoy playing the games. Like, I have so much fun going to these tournaments and hanging out with like all the people I've met because of these card games. Like most of the people that I'm very close to now, I would not have met if it weren't for card games. So
for sure. And that's really interesting because that's not really why I compete. And I don't think that's why a lot of people compete in specifically Flesh and Blood, because there's always the old adage, if you're playing Flesh and Blood or Magic for the money, like there are better things to be doing with your time. And the fun aspect is definitely there, but I think I talked about this a little bit in one of our first podcasts. I definitely remember talking about this at some point in time, where whatever I'm doing, whatever my hobby is, I always view it as something that I need to be like improving upon and feel like I'm making progress in it. And one of the easiest ways to know like how good or how much progress you've made then is to then show up and do a competition where you can see, well, how good is everybody else? How good are you? How good are the people who are winning? And like, where are you on that spectrum? And when you start improving, you should start slowly seeing yourself move up, you know, in the competition standings or in your understanding of what's going wrong, and just slowly, you know, going through that process of like improving. And I really enjoy that. And it's why, you know, I can sit down and play like Baldur's Gate 3, but like I could never just have video games like that be like my main hobby or something like that, or like my main drive to get me out of bed in the morning. I always want what I'm doing to have that measure of like me versus something else that I can, that's like tangible and relatable. And I think that's kind of why a lot of people compete. It's just like, it's fun to see yourself getting better. It's fun to, you know, engage and have these kinds of competitions. And just because you do really, really well at them, you know, sometimes you can spike a tournament and get lucky. Like, so that's not always not like the best measure individually. But yeah, I guess in the long run, that's just like kind of my perspective on it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of people share that. That's why ladder systems are so popular, is because like you literally just like, last year I was 1600, this year I'm 1800. Like you literally just, it's just a number that has gotten better as you've got improved at the game. And it's just like very clear. Whereas I guess compare that to tournaments where like there's a lot of variance in an individual tournament's result.
Yeah. I guess speaking of numbers, ladders, and tournaments that get bitten bigger or lower depending on when you win or lose, have we ever discussed ELO on the podcast, like the more recent unified ELO changes or anything like that?
No, we haven't said anything about the ELO changes. Do you want to talk about that today?
Yeah, let's touch on that a little bit. All
right, let's jump in.
How do you feel about ELO? How is your ELO doing after Road to National season?
I only played two RTNs, and RTNs, like, you play like five rounds and the K factor is eight. I got top eight and lost the first round of top eight at one, and I got second at the other one. And I haven't even checked the ELO change from the more recent one, but the first one I lost like five ELO or something. And it's like, you know, whatever.
In the top eight amount. Of the calling though, you lost ELO in that one though, right?
I did lose ELO for top eighting Hartford. Yeah.
That's insane to me. Like, I think that's the biggest issue I have with ELO at the moment, where it's just like, it seems way too, the K factor seems way too high at the moment and way too swingy between like the larger events, or just like in general, where it's like, I lost more ELO for going 0-2 drop in the calling that I got for getting second place in the battle hard in the month prior. Like that was getting second place in like the third level, fourth level premier events, basically above PTI, or I guess like PTS don't even offer ELO, but like the baseline ELO event, then our battle hardens, getting second place in one of those is actually less significant than this, just like having a suboptimal or bad performance at a calling. And it's just like, that feels really weird to me. And yeah.
So I actually, I wish I did more research into this before the episode, because if I knew we were talking about ELO, I'd actually get the stats and figure out how it works. But I know that the way ELO works is like, if you're 200 points above someone, you're supposed to beat them like 80% of the time. If you're 400 points above someone, you're supposed to beat them like 95 or 99 or some really high percentage of the time. And because we're playing a card game, it's just so hard to be that much better than someone where you're going to beat them 95% of the time. And even beating them 80% of the time is really, really difficult. And that's why because you're supposed to win that often when you're just 200 points higher than someone. I can see you looking at something up now. Hopefully you're pulling up the real numbers. But because that's how ELO, like the whole system of ELO works, when our K factors are 64, then like you're gonna get to 200 points higher than someone when you might be like the same skill level or slightly better than them so often because the K factors are so swingy. I think if they wanted to use ELO exactly and have the system calibrated is the right term. I think the K factor should be like one or two for PTIs and or RTN level events. Then like they should top out at like 8 or 16 K factor, like a fourth to an eighth of what it is now, because that way that would be more accurate. So if someone actually got to be 200 points higher than someone else, you would expect them to beat them 80% of the time, because that means they've been winning so consistently to get that many points. Whereas with our K factors, the way they are with how the ELO system works, it just means that ELO is always going to be swingy. And it's not intrinsic to ELO itself. It's just because the K factors are so high.
Yeah. I'm on the Wikipedia page for ELO systems. I can't find the specific distributions for how often players are supposed to a player's expected scores, the probability of winning, the probability of drawing. Thus, the expected score of 0.75 could represent a 75% chance of winning and a 25% chance of losing and a 0% chance of drawing. Yeah, I don't know. We'd have to sit down and do more research into this, but I get what you're saying.
So, but basically, that's why your swings are so big when you're so high ELO. Let's say I'm playing against someone that is 200 or 300 points lower than me. If I win, I'm going to get 2. If I lose, I'm going to lose 6, because I'm supposed to win that game 75% of the time based on my score being higher than them. And when you get to the plus 7s, minus 1s, which are pretty common in RTN events, that means I'm supposed to win 7 out of 8 times if we play the game 8 times. And just because of the nature of card games, the variance that does exist in them, it's hard to have a win rate that is the 87.5% win rate that 7 out of 8 is. Like, That's just really difficult, but your ELO says you're at that point so often when the K factors are 32 or 64. It's just because your ELO swings so high.
When you have a win rate higher than that, right, in a specific tournament. So like in The Calling, what was your overall record? Like it was like after you lost in top 8, it was like
11-3, I think.
11-3 total. Like that's higher 12 than
12-3.
That's still higher than 80% win rate, right? I don't know.
No, 12-3 would be an 80% win rate. And I actually think it was 11-4. I think I top eighted with 3 losses. So I lost once day 1, and I lost twice day 2.
It was 6 rounds. No, it was 12 rounds.
It was 8 rounds day 1, 6 rounds day 2.
So 14 rounds,
and then the top 8 is the 15th round when I lost. So I went 11-4.
Okay. So yeah, you had a 74% win rate. I guess that just shows why you lost so much ELO then, you know? If only you won one more match.
Because my ELO is so high, I'm expected to win more than 70% of my games. But, like, I just think the ELO is if they wanted the ELO to be accurate and representative, then the K factor needs to be significantly lower. But I think they don't mind the big swingy things. I don't think they're trying to be like, I don't think ELO is supposed to say who's. I mean, it's kind of supposed to say who's the best, but like right now what it says is who's done well at the recent events, because if you like both the years after the world champion, who won the world champion was like number 1 in the ELO boards. I think it's very basically after every pro tour except PT3, the person that won was first. I think Michael Fung was not first after he won his pro tour, but every other pro tour it's been the case where whoever won was first afterwards. Pablo was first and Matt Folks was first. And that's just because it's so swiggy. It's not like the K factors are so high. That player may that, I don't know. It just, you get so many points for these events and it's not truly reflective of what your expected win rate into the field is. It's just because, or it's because the K factor is so high.
What do you think about the combined ELO at the moment now between limited and constructed? Did you prefer it bifurcated or do you like it singular?
So for me, as someone who has done reasonably well on both constructed and limited, having the ELOs separate means that, like, with how swingy it is, if I bomb horribly at an event of one type, like maybe there's two constructed callings and I 0-3 drop the first one and then I 2-3 drop the second one, then like that would knock me out of the constructed leaderboard, but I'd still have my limited ELO board, ELO spot that would get me invites. With it being combined, now if I bomb a constructed calling and then I bomb another constructed calling back to back, I'm just off the top 8 leaderboards. So, or the top, not top 8, the top 50, whatever the thing is, because it's just all together. And that kind of that kind of sucks, but I think that's more a factor of it being so swingy than the issue of it being they're both combined. It's just like, now if I have two bad tournaments in a row with how swingy ELO is, I'll probably be off the leaderboards. But like, honestly, that's a what's a complaint, a first world problem thing where I think ultimately if their goal is just to know who's good, who's doing well at Flesh and Blood events, then combining it is fine.
Yeah, I guess my issue was that I understand it's different now, but back when it was separated, since there was the calling in 2021, 2022, for limited, and that was like one of the first opportunities in the United States to get like limited ELO. And then after that, the only way to get limited ELO was in Pro Tours, Nationals, or the Worlds. And that was it. And it's like, that's not great. Just because how can you really know what somebody's performance was in limited when there's so few opportunities to really gain that ELO system? And I think that still kind of holds true, where basically just the lack of limited opportunities to gain ELO just makes that system awkward. I guess it's less awkward now that it's just always just one unified ELO, because it doesn't, there's no distinguishing difference between the two. But that was always kind of something that rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah. It also, even if you were queued for the Pro Tour, like, you're going to do one draft if you don't day two. Is one draft really going to give a good idea of where your limited ELO should be?
Yeah, I was like top 50 after having my top 16 finish in Cincinnati or whatever. And then like I played in like two or three premier level events, like either two nationals or I think it was two nationals Leo and one pro tour.
Leo and nationals.
Yeah. Or was it one nationals and one pro tour? I don't know.
You played both nationals, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was then three nationals. And then I was
two nationals and a pro tour.
Two nationals and a pro tour. I was basically at 1500 again. I was at baseline ELO again. And that was also because like this is a whole nother can of worms, but like I think I've lost like probably 100 to 200 ELO at pro tours or nationals now because I hit drop me after and then it doesn't drop me. And then I get paired into my next round. And guess what? Goodbye, 100 ELO. Just bye. You weren't actually dropped, idiot. And it's like, oh, cool. That's sweet.
Yeah, that's a
oh well. What are you gonna do?
I think the dropping should be a separate confirmation in Gem. I don't think it should be attached to your match result. It should just be like, I want to drop, and then it pops up a little confirmation. You're sure you want to drop, and then you click yes, and then you can do that before or after you submit. I think that would be much, much better than this little checkbox of drop me after.
I just don't trust it anymore. After I forget which event it was. After I got repaired again, and I know it happened to me in Lille 100%, and yeah. Then it happened. It must have been at the nationals after that. Ever since then, now I go up to the judge at the standings after when I want to drop, and I say, "Please drop me, please. I don't want to play in this tournament anymore. Can you confirm that I'm dropped?" I just click the drop button. Can you confirm that I'm dropped? And I think every single time they've been like, "Oh yeah, no, you were still in the tournament. I'll drop you." Thank God I didn't just spew another 100 ELO here. That was lucky. Yeah. I'm glad I went and actually talked to them about what I actually wanted to do.
Yeah.
But that's a real first world problem.
There's also been stories in the other direction too, where someone either didn't mean to or...
Yeah, Caleb, or Majin Bay, in the last Nationals. Hartford, it was the limited calling where he was dropped somehow and they were like, sorry, you just get a round loss now. Which
he got sucked in that battle harder the next day, which is at least he has a good story out of it. But like, that sucks.
And because there's not much you can do about it, because like otherwise it just incentivizes backers where it's just like, oh, drop. And then it's just like, oh, well, like, what are you going to repair the whole tournament? No. Are you going to give them a win? Well, then it's like, that's not cool. So it's just a really shitty thing that just is going to be a part of the system sometimes, I think.
And I don't think it should be. I think that's kind of why I'm advocating for it not to be a little check mark in your gem reporting. It should be a separate button that you click at any time. That's like, I want to drop from this event. You click it and a confirmation comes up. And it's like, are you sure you want to drop from the
tournament? That's fair.
And you just click yes. And then like, that can't happen. You can't really, like, you can't accidentally do that, but it's much less likely than like you accidentally tick this check mark.
Yeah. You know what we could do? Do you remember the good old fashioned match slips? Remember paper match slips? That was for the boomer days. Can you sign my match slip, please? And it was always the most awkward thing in the world because like sometimes you get a really salty opponent and you'd have like the match slip in front of them and you'd just be like sitting there like, when are they going to sign the match slip? But like, you're not going to be. I don't miss it, but I remember it was at least a surefire way to get things right.
Yeah.
Maybe not surefire way, but a better way to get things right, I guess. I don't know.
I think there's also like a lot of logistical, like extra work on the judge staff to like have someone actually just typing in each result from each of the match slips instead of just like when we can just input it ourselves on our phones.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. Tournaments are hard. Flesh and blood is hard.
At big events, there's judges whose whole job was just like inputting the different each of the little sheets they had to type it in.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh well. Any final thoughts then about Evo, teams, life? Anything you want to touch on before we sign off then?
Well, this discussion kind of drifted a little bit from the team topic that was originally planned. I guess that's kind of just how our podcast is. We just kind of talk about things we want to talk about in the flesh and blood world. I do think there are a lot of small fixes they could do to, I don't know. Elo's like, I think the current Elo system has a lot of problems, and I think small adjustments would fix some of them. But I also think that Elo is probably not the best way to determine who should be invited to events.
That's fair. Yeah, I agree. I don't know what the perfect solution is. A lot of people point to the old Pro Tour Pro Point system thing where it's just like, I don't know. Sure, whatever. Maybe one day they can do that. But for right now, the system is what it is. I don't ultimately hate it too much. I don't hate it at all. I'm just kind of ambivalent about it, where it's just like, it is what it is. Like, sure, you'll have swingy Elo and you just kind of have to ride it out, but we'll see.
Yeah. I really like trying to design what best possible systems would be, or really like better systems would be. I always like improving things. And I think that either lowering the K factor or moving to something like a Pro Point system, something like that would probably make things feel better for players. I hope they make improvements. I think there's been a lot of medium to negative feedback about it. And I don't think anyone's like, yeah, I love how Elo works right now. So.
Well, the next time you're losing Elo on your O2 drop from a calling, always remember, mind your manners. Thanks for watching.